From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The hulks of harvest time are reaping a bountiful gridiron yield. I can't believe I just said that. Ahead on Only a Game, a college football roundup without the hyperbole. Also, the story of a husband and wife coaching team who bring their combined basketball expertise to the Carolina hardwood, and the life of boxer Sugar Ray Robinson. Also ahead, the Lingerie Football League impresses diehard football connoisseurs who just don't care so much about the garters and lacy things.
It is amazing, absolutely amazing, because you know what? It shows that they're actually physically athletes. It's not just about being women and scantily wearing outfits. It's about football, and everybody loves football.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. College football fans who enjoy high-scoring tilts were no doubt thrilled by at least a couple of last night's games, especially if they root for number 6 Boise State and number 5 Cincinnati. The former beat Nevada 44-33. The latter gave up 36 points to Illinois and won anyway, because 49 is more than 36. In closer games, number 2 Alabama came from behind twice to beat rival Auburn 26-21, and on the strength of a field goal as time was running out, West Virginia knocked off number 9 Pittsburgh 19-16. Joining me now to discuss one of college football's biggest weekends is CBSSports.com national columnist Greg Doyle. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Real well, thank you. The top-ranked Florida Gators play Florida State today. The Seminoles have struggled at times this year, but they've won 4 of their last 5. Will the Gators remain undefeated?
Yeah, the only question is, will they remain undefeated and win by 40, or will they remain undefeated and win by 25 or 30? There's a huge talent gap between them and Florida State.
Number 3 Texas defeated Texas A&M 49-39 on Thanksgiving Day. How do you like the Longhorns' chances of winning it all?
You know, in this college football season, I really like any number of teams' chances of winning it all, because there is no great team. Texas beating A&M the way they beat them kind of shows what I'm talking about, is that A&M is an average team at best, and that average team at best rang up almost 40 points on Texas. If you're supposed to be a national championship team, you don't give up 40 points to Texas A&M, not this year. But who out there is remarkably better than Texas? Is Florida that much better? Alabama? I mean, Boise, Cincinnati? Nobody's great. Nobody.
Texas Christian University is 11-0. They play New Mexico this afternoon. The BCS formula puts TCU below Florida, Alabama, and Texas. Is there any way for the Horned Frogs to leap over one of the top 3? And I apologize for that.
Yeah, there is. It's not easy, and it's out of their control. They got to win their game, but then Texas has to lose in the Big 12 title game. And they get Texas a spot, because really, unless Florida loses to Florida State, and I'm telling you right now, that just will not happen. Because in addition to the talent gap, Florida has a coach who actually understands what he's watching, whereas Florida State's coach has no idea what's going on. The only way they get in is if Texas loses the Big 12 title game, because whoever wins Alabama, Florida, will be in the title game also. My thing with Texas Christian is this. If you're going to be a team like TCU or Boise or Cincinnati and not come from a great conference, you better beat the crap out of everybody you play. Otherwise, how am I supposed to take you seriously? You're beating bad teams, yeah, and you're not even beating them that badly. Well, Texas Christian pretty much destroys everybody they play. So they're the one team on the outside looking in that I would not mind seeing in the title game if they could get there.
Greg, just out of curiosity, how much is the coach at Florida State paid to not know what's going on?
About $2.5 million too much. He won't go away. It's one of those deals where, you know, Bobby Bowden and Joe Paterno at Penn State too, but at least he's still winning. They view their job as a Supreme Court appointment. It's like having a guest at your house, and he thinks he owns it. Look, you don't own this house, Bobby. You've lived here for a long time, and you paid your rent, you paid your bills, and it's been a mutually beneficial thing. But our house now needs to move on, and you won't leave.
Today is a day for rivalries. Virginia Tech faces Virginia, Oklahoma State against Oklahoma, Missouri against Kansas, just to name a few. Number 7 Georgia Tech plays unranked Georgia this afternoon. How important is today's game to the Yellow Jackets' bowl hopes?
Well, actually, it's not that important, because they're going to go to a BCS bowl only one way. They're going to have to win the ACC championship game. I really don't think if they lose the ACC title game, no matter what happens against Georgia, they're going to go to a BCS bowl. So today is just icing on the cake. And it's really insulting if you're a Georgia fan, because Georgia Tech has really high academic standards to get kids into school, and Georgia, let's be honest, doesn't.
Notre Dame takes on Stanford today. There's been much speculation that Notre Dame head coach and alum Charlie Weiss could lose his job after this season. Even Weiss himself has been speculating about that. Would a Fighting Irish victory today be enough to save him?
No, it might be enough to save him the embarrassment of people throwing eggs at his moving van when he leaves town. But they could beat Stanford by 40 and he's gone. I've never seen a coach enter the last game of the year more fired than this coach. In fact, he normally stays out west and recruits after this final game and was planning to stay out west and recruit after this final game. And unlike Bobby Bowden, who won't leave, Notre Dame can tell Charlie Weiss to leave. They said, Charlie, guess what? You're not recruiting after this game. You're coming back and bring your playbook with you. So he's so fired. I mean, he knows he's gone. It doesn't matter what happens in the game. He's gone. It would not be a bad idea, actually, to announce he's fired before the game, really, just so people can stop speculating on it, because the speculation is ridiculous. It's like speculating, is the sun going to rise tomorrow in the east? I hope I got that right. But, yeah, it's going to rise tomorrow in the east. I mean, maybe I'll make sense tomorrow. That's doubtful. The sun rising, Charlie Weiss being fired, they're factual.
Greg, sometimes undefeated teams drop in the rankings due to weak schedules or narrow victories. But coming into this holiday weekend, there were six undefeated teams, and they were ranked 1 through 6. Is this the tightest BCS race that you've seen?
Yeah, normally there's one BCS buster, one cute little cuddly team. We pat Utah on the head and say, thank you, Utah, for playing. Now go away. Same for you, Boise State. This year we've got three of them. But none of them are doing what they ought to be doing on a consistent basis outside of TCU. TCU's beaten the crud out of everybody. Florida's barely beaten some decent teams. Alabama's barely beaten some decent teams. Texas is giving up 40 almost to Texas A&M. What we have is a log jam at the top. It's usually has some separation at the top. The cream, you know, rises above. But this year there's no cream. There's just a whole bunch of milk up there. And, you know, there's some 2%, some skim. It's all milk. It's none of it's cream.
All right, this has been a very pleasant conversation, and I very much appreciate the laughs, but it's time to put you on the hot seat. We need your BCS title game predictions.
Florida's going to get there. I'm a Florida grad, but Florida grads would tell you I'm a terrible Florida grad. I've ripped Tebow. I've ripped Urban Meyer. I'm not a homer. But anyway, Florida will get there. They'll play Texas. And Texas can score 40 and probably will. Florida can't score 40 and definitely won't. So Texas will win 40-24.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com. Greg, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on.
On Monday, the football program at Northeastern University in Boston was thrown for the ultimate loss when athletics director Peter Roby announced the elimination of the sport. Northeastern hadn't had a winning season since 2004, but lots of college football teams lose more often than they win. Northeastern's problem, according to Roby, was money.
It was clear that in order for us to compete at a level that we wanted to against the programs that we have to play against in the Colonial Athletic Association, it was going to require investments in the multiples of millions of dollars, because we needed to address our facility. We needed to upgrade investments we were making in our operation. And if we were going to make a coaching change, we were going to have to make it enticing for any new person that was going to invest their time and energy in their career. And I just didn't feel I could make that recommendation to the senior leadership of the institution.
Many Northeastern players who learned of Roby's decision on Sunday evening were disappointed. Though attendance at home games has averaged only about 1,500, some of Northeastern's fans were upset too. But among those applauding the decision was Boston Globe columnist Derek Jackson. His Tuesday column began, "Go Northeastern, I cheer you for cutting football. Your final touchdown was a score for sanity." At most colleges and universities that feature the sport, football loses money. In the Football Championship Series subdivision, where Northeastern played, 24 out of every 25 football programs were in the red in 2006. Still, for some, college football carries a cachet that trumps dollars, even millions of dollars in losses, and I asked Derek Jackson if his column had provoked hate mail. He acknowledged that there had been some grumbling, but said he's also heard from readers who agreed with him.
In fact, a couple letter writers made a case that Northeastern should take that $3 million that is saved from the football and put it toward, at this particularly bad economic time in the United States, put it toward regular student aid. And I think some schools, that might be the best argument to make, that, listen, this $3 million a year we're spending is better spent on getting the brain power in here that will ultimately make our school a world-class institution.
Some maintain that it would make sense for other schools continuing to fund football to adopt that logic. Mark Ziegler is a reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. For several years, he's been following the fortunes of the football team at San Diego State University, and there he has discovered some creative accounting.
At San Diego State, they'll tell you that it makes money, actually. The most recent one we had, it claimed to made almost $2.5 million in profit. Some of the San Diego State's own accounting professors looked at this and said, that's not accepted accounting practices, and if we were to do it, we'd come up with a rather large loss.
Mark Ziegler acknowledges that at the schools where football is entrenched in the campus culture, schools like Ohio State, Nebraska, and Notre Dame, where ticket sales, bowl revenues, and TV money are available and boosters make substantial contributions, football not only shows a profit, but helps support other programs in the athletic department. But he says that San Diego State, like Northeastern, does not fit that model.
They've done a little bit better than last year, but there was a game a few weeks ago, I think the announced crowd was 10 or 12,000, and people who were there said that there weren't more than 5,000 people in a stadium that seats close to 70,000. The university has, I believe, 34,000 students, and on an average football game, they might have a couple hundred out there, and students get in for free.
Okay, supporters of football might argue maybe the undergrads aren't showing up in great numbers for games, but don't alumni contributions to the university as a whole increase when said alums have a successful football team to follow? According to Dan Falks, an accounting professor at Transylvania University in Kentucky and a research consultant to the NCAA, not so much.
And maybe this is more anecdotal, but if it does increase donations, very typically, those are earmarked for athletics. A successful football program does not get you money for the library.
As a numbers guy, Professor Falks has ascertained that while some of the rich college football programs, which pay their coaches millions of dollars a year and build weight rooms that resemble country clubs, are getting richer, the poor programs are losing more and more money. Accordingly, he can't quarrel with the decision Peter Roby announced this week.
Bottom line is, if you're not selling tickets and you're not getting people back on campus, then there's no need to have this program. So it's probably a good decision.
The current economic climate and the increasingly dramatic gap between college football's haves and have-nots suggest that more colleges and universities may be considering the same decision. Tiger Woods was injured early Friday morning when he backed his SUV out of the driveway in his Isleworth, Florida home, hit a fire hydrant, and then ran into a tree. Woods suffered facial lacerations and was treated at a nearby hospital before being released, at which time his condition was reported to be good. It is not clear whether Woods will be able to participate in next week's Chevron World Challenge, a tournament that benefits his charitable foundation. It's 19 minutes past the hour. The rules of soccer are harsh, and some officials enforce them harshly. That was apparent at a game played recently in Zagreb involving the Croatian First Division teams Šibenik and Međimurje Čakovec. In the 20th minute of the match, the latter club's goalkeeper, Ivan Benović, saw a cat wandering onto the pitch. Motivated either by concern for the cat's safety or some superstition involving cats, Croatia, and soccer, Benović scooped up the feline and carried it to a safe place near the scoreboard. The ref responded by issuing Benović a yellow card for leaving the pitch without permission, a ruling that caused the fans to taunt the official mercilessly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the life and bouts of boxer Sugar Ray Robinson. But first, on January 24th, Kay Yao passed away at the age of 66, but she left a legacy that will be long remembered. Yao is credited with 737 wins, most of them as the North Carolina State women's head basketball coach. She led the U.S. Olympic team to the 1988 gold medal in Seoul, and her 20-year battle with breast cancer was inspirational to many. Just a few months after Yao's death, new NC State head coach Kelly Harper is forging her own identity with a longtime assistant. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio reports.
Deep underneath the stands in Reynolds Coliseum, a large mural greets visitors outside the women's basketball offices. In it, Kay Yao stands tall and directs players. Inside the offices, trophies from her career occupy the prime spots in cases along the wall. This is not usually how it's done. When new coaches arrive, they usually sweep away all signs of the old regime. But Kelly Harper knows there's no replacing Kay Yao.
She was the tradition here at NC State, and we want to continue what she was doing. We want to raise the bar. We want to keep this program or put this program in national prominence, and that's the best way to honor her.
One of Yao's last acts was to recommend her successor, but that person, good friend and longtime assistant Stephanie Glantz, did not get the job. NC State cited the need for a new direction, but fans and alumni howled. Players were just as shocked. Junior forward Tia Bell lived through her coach's death last winter and the coaching change a few months later.
Our support system that we had been taken away from us, and it was really an emotional attachment there. I also knew that if Coach Glantz would have stayed, it would have been a lot of memories that would have stuck around and a lot of emotions. And but when she was there for us and served as a great support system.
Kelly Harper has already built strong relationships with her new players, but today she's glaring at them during practice. She's clearly not happy with the effort.
That is the most pitiful excuse for starting practice I've ever seen. We're hitting people in the head, we're missing layups, we're making turnovers against token defense.
As the players break the huddle, Harper walks toward the sideline and leans in to talk to one of her assistant coaches. But he's not just any assistant. John Harper is also Kelly's husband. Over the course of practice, this scene is repeated countless times. The head coach and the assistant, the wife and the husband, managing practice together. John Harper says the last thing Kelly wants is someone who always agrees with her.
It's certainly different. You know, we're probably a lot more casual with each other than a typical assistant coach, head coach situation. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I maybe should keep my mouth shut more than I do. But at the same time, I do know she wants that.
Kelly and John took their first coaching jobs together as newlyweds 10 years ago. They started as assistant coaches at Tennessee Chattanooga. Then John followed Kelly when she was named the head coach at Western Carolina University. And now at NC State, where their relationship was one more new thing to get used to for players like Tia Bell.
Wow, that was a first. I don't think I've ever played or heard of a marriage couple coaching together. I guess it'll build chemistry there, and I guess your team is like your family is your family. So we got used to it quick. Again, on the court, I guess they leave their personal business behind, so.
And the NC State program truly does get two Harpers for the price of one. Because of state and university nepotism rules, John Harper isn't drawing a salary. That's just one more way that many red-blooded American males might find the situation a little hard to take.
No offense to all the guys out there, but a lot of men couldn't do what he does. His ego is checked every single day, and he sits back and takes it all in from a different seat and handles it.
Six other Division I women's basketball programs have this same arrangement, where the wife is the head coach and the husband is an assistant. But it's hard to imagine a circumstance under which two members of a coaching staff will depend upon each other more. Trying to replace a legendary coach who personified courage and winning back the fans and alumni won't stop at practice or in the office.
I can't imagine going home after a loss and my husband patting me on the back and saying it's okay. It's not okay. We just lost. So when I go home in those moments now, he's just as miserable as I am. You know, folks say you can't take it home. We can't not take it home.
It's likely there will be a lot of losing in NC State's future. Recruiting has been sporadic the last few years, and the current talent level is thin. But the Harpers' 24-hour devotion and energy is already winning people over. Even Greensboro News and Record sports columnist Ed Hardin, who was critical of NC State's decision to hire Harper.
I think Kelly's going to do it, though. I really do. That may sound strange to say after what I've written and after what I've said, but, you know, life does go on, and at NC State, it's going to go on with Kelly Harper, and that's just the way it is.
It will go on not just with Kelly Harper, but also her assistant coach and husband, John. You'd think after 10 years their roles would be completely defined, but not so, says Kelly.
Occasionally I'll ask him to do something and he'll want to know if that's the wife talking or the coach talking. I could possibly abuse those privileges at times, but as a coach, you want to work with people you like. No, I mean, I kind of like him, so it's really a blessing that we have this opportunity.
For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Y'all, this is stuff that we have done the first week of practice.
Sugar Ray Robinson's boxing career was notable for lots of reasons. He was the sport's middleweight champion 5 times. Win or lose, he was the personification of style. Among his friends and admirers, he numbered Langston Hughes, Miles Davis, and Lena Horne. In his new book, Sweet Thunder, Will Haygood tells the story of Robinson's rise to prominence, his years as a champion, his achievements beyond the ring, and his decline into dementia. Will Haygood joins me now from National Public Radio in Washington. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's begin with a story of how a young man named Walker Smith Jr. became Ray Robinson.
He was on an AAU team out of Harlem. He went to Watertown, New York, and he wasn't even supposed to fight. He was kind of the last man on the team, you might say. And there was a genuine Ray Robinson, but he was ill and couldn't fight that night. And Walker Smith Jr. begged the manager, George Gainford, "Let me fight, coach. Let me fight." He knocked out his opponent, a sportscaster there from the Watertown newspaper by the name of Jack Case said, "Goodness, that's a sweet fighter there." And a lady stood up at ringside and said, "Indeed he is, sweet as sugar." And so the fraudulent named fighter, Walker Smith, fighting as Ray Robinson, in the next day's newspapers, he became Sugar Ray Robinson. Mm-hmm. And Walker Smith loved the name and it stuck.
And you have to wonder what happened to the original Ray Robinson. I mean, did he go on to a glorious career as a plumber or something?
No, that's a great question because I tried to find him. He quit fighting about 3 years later, and we never heard from him again.
Some of Robinson's most memorable fights were his bouts against Jake LaMotta. LaMotta used to claim that he fought Sugar Ray so often that he got diabetes. To what extent were those matches and rematches over the course of more than a decade responsible for Robinson's reputation?
Hugely so, because it brought in a rivalry. There were people who wanted Sugar Ray Robinson to win very passionately, especially blacks, and there were people who wanted Mr. LaMotta to win, Italians especially. Mr. LaMotta won the first fight, but Robinson won the succeeding 5 fights. Mm. But it's interesting, from the Scorsese movie Raging Bull, you would think that their fights were somewhat even, but they were not. Robinson, he dominated that rivalry.
Well, you bring up an interesting question in the book, which is, why has nobody made a movie of Sugar Ray Robinson? They made Raging Bull, but so far, no Sugar Ray.
And they made Rocky Graziano. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe this book will serve as a cinematic roadmap to Hollywood. He deserves it, you know, because he was a fascinating, enigmatic character.
Jimmy Doyle left the ring on a stretcher the night he fought Robinson in 1947, and he died shortly thereafter in a hospital. What effect, if any, did that have on Robinson?
I think fighters know going into the ring that anything might happen, but it is interesting. Robinson kept fight films on tapes. He had fight tapes of him and Gene Fulmer, him and Rocky Graziano. The only fight that he did not have in his collection was that 13-round battle, fateful battle against Jimmy Doyle. And so I think he did not want to be reminded of it. I think he was scarred in ways that we don't really know, but it's interesting. He lived in L.A., and he lived less than 2 miles from Jimmy Doyle's home. And when Doyle died, Robinson did something I think was very nice. He went around the country and fought 6 fights against tough fighters. And the money that he won, he presented a check to Duell's mother because her son, Jimmy Duell, said, I only want to fight one more time to make enough money to get my mom a house.
Hmm. Robinson's record was 173 wins against just 19 losses and 6 draws. That sounds like an awful lot of fights, even considering that Robinson fought for a quarter of a century.
It does, and Bill, what is amazing, I think, is that star fighters these days might fight 2-3 times a year. Robinson was fighting often twice a month, mm-hmm. sometimes 3 times a month. So you can imagine his injuries would not be 100% healed. He could take a punch, though. He was one of those rare fighters. He could dish out a lot of blows, but he could also take a lot of blows, and he did.
You write that Ray Robinson, quote, hated the business of the fight game, which included the influence of gangsters like Frankie Carbo, a.k.a. Mr. Fury, as you say in the book. How did Robinson go about distancing himself from that business?
He would go to clean fight promoters, but often they would not give him the kind of money he thought he should have. And so Robinson would go right up to like 2 days before the fight, and he would say, okay, now the fight's all scheduled, and you said that you were going to give me $20,000. It's not enough. And then they would say, well, Mr. Robinson, we've printed the tickets. We've done advertisements in the newspapers, on the radio. What are you talking about? He said, well, you can cancel the fight, but then again, who'll win then? You've lost all the money in advertising, and all of those tickets will have to be torn up. So, your move. You know, that's how he dealt with them. He was sort of cagey that way.
Ray Robinson, like many boxers, retired and then unretired, and I guess there can be no doubt that he stayed too long in the ring. Jazz legend Miles Davis was among those who urged him to quit. Was the problem that Robinson just couldn't afford to stay retired?
Yes, there was some of that. You know, he owned a string of businesses in Harlem. When he retired for the first time in 1952, one of his passions was entertainment. He wanted to be a tap dancer, so he traveled all over the world. You know, he was a decent tap dancer, but you know, he wasn't a great tap dancer. He was no Fred Astaire. But being away from your businesses 3 years, they can suffer. And they started losing money. So 3 years away, a lot of money was lost. And the only way for Sugar Ray Robinson, a black man in America in 1955, could make anything approaching, say, $100,000 a year was through fighting. And so he went back to the ring.
You write of Robinson that, I'm quoting now, fatherhood bewildered him. It's an interesting phrase. What did you mean by that?
Well, his own father abandoned his family when he was 8 years old, and he had 2 sons that he was never very close to. A fighter, like an entertainer, is on the road 38, 45 weeks a year. And so Robinson really never slowed down, which I really think generally points to the end of his life when he started a youth foundation out in L.A. It was called and still is the Sugar Ray Robinson Youth Foundation. Mm-hmm. I think he saw that as an opportunity to become a kind of intimate father figure.
I'm speaking with Will Haygood, the author of Sweet Thunder, The Life and Times of Sugar Ray Robinson. You're listening to Only a Game. One interesting feature of that youth foundation, it's set up to help at-risk children and provides them with, among other things, athletic opportunities. But Robinson didn't want the kids to learn boxing. Why not?
You're exactly right. And I think that's a very touching part of the story. I don't think Sugar Ray Robinson wanted a little boy after a boxing match at the youth center to come home and to be in some kind of pain or whatever and not have a father walk into that bedroom at night and put his arms around him and say, it's all right, son. And so Robinson told the staff, we will have fashion modeling, we will have badminton, we will have track, but there will be no fighting.
Ray Robinson was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease when he was only 63 years old, 4 or 5 years before he died. Was there ever any attempt to ascertain the extent to which boxing contributed to his illness?
Not really, but I think with the studies that have been done since his death, I think we can look back and I think we can fairly certainly say that those, 170 plus fights certainly added to his health woes late in life. And middleweights, they have some of the welterweights' quickness and slipperiness, and they have some of the heavyweights' power and strength. And so Robinson, while he had those tools, all of the fighters who he fought against also had those tools. And so he fought so often that it was impossible to avoid all of those blows. And many of the fighters he fought, Gene Fulmer, Rocky Graziano, and Jake LaMotta, they were hard, hard hitters. The middleweights of the 50s were some of the best fighters that the fight game has ever seen.
Will Haygood, who writes for The Washington Post, is most recently the author of Sweet Thunder, The Life and Times of Sugar Ray Robinson, published by Knopf. He joined me from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Will, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was an honor, and thank you very much.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cincinnati has the Bengals, who look very much like a playoff-bound team. Cincinnati has the Reds as well, and if they haven't been especially successful lately, their history is both long and honorable. Well, mostly honorable. Anyway, Cincinnati also has frozen turkey bowling. In this endeavor, participants slide frozen turkeys across a hockey rink, where congestion is no problem since Cincinnati has no NHL team, toward a standard arrangement of bowling pins. It's not clear whether anyone eats the bowled turkeys, but whoever knocks down the most pins gets $100, which makes it a competition, which makes it a sport. So there, happy belated Thanksgiving. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, scantily clad football players. Ooh. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Happy 2 days after Thanksgiving. Charlie, see any good games?
Actually, I did not. I saw a couple of pretty good basketball games, but I didn't see very many good football games.
What kind of American are you, anyway? The time has come again to talk of injured quarterbacks. Jimmy Clausen will apparently start at quarterback for Notre Dame against Stanford today, despite the fact that he was, and I am quoting, the Notre Dame athletic director now, cold-cocked in a bar on Saturday night. Good idea for him to play?
Well, you know, I hope that when they play Stanford, if they do happen to lose, and it's likely that the Irish will lose the game, that he and his family and girlfriend stay out of CJ's pub at hours in single digits. Because, as we all know, almost nothing bad can happen when you're in a bar with your family and your girlfriend at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're a high-profile athlete of a team that's in the process of screwing the pooch. What can possibly go wrong? Got whacked by a fan, by a Notre Dame fan, no less.
And there's lots of Notre Dame fans into that sort of thing this year, I understand. Also cold-cocked recently, though on the field rather than in a bar, was Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger, no stranger to getting cold-cocked he, with at least 4 concussions over the last 3 seasons. Shouldn't he be resting quietly at home this week?
he should be resting quietly at home the rest of the year. The NFL, I mean, he's rambling his mouth again about how it's the nature of the beast and there's a chance you're going to get hit. And you guys don't talk about the bruises we have all over our body. No, because that's not going to turn your mind to cottage cheese in 10 years, Ben.
Perhaps, ironically, Dr. Ira Kaysen, the NFL-employed physician infamous for maintaining that there is no link between multiple head injuries and brain disorders, resigned this week. Does this change everything, I mean, for everybody except Ben Roethlisberger?
Well, it is an interesting little window into the mind of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who seems to be coming around on the issue pretty quickly. The consistent drumbeat, which is turning up now about how many of these players have concussions and how many of these players play with repeated concussions, is starting to become overwhelming. I mean, there is a new helmet design now, apparently. The fact that the denialists, as we say in the climate change game, are being run off the panel, I would say, is a good sign.
Last week, Cleveland Browns coach Eric Mangini accused the Detroit Lions of faking injuries in order to run out the clock while the Lions were beating the Browns. This week, he's apologizing. Did Mangini come up with a better excuse for losing to the Lions?
Probably not. He's approximately successful at making excuses as he is at coaching the Browns right now. This is not unusual, of course. The Buffalo Bills used to do it the year that they played Cincinnati for the right to go to the Super Bowl and lose to San Francisco. There was a lot of lying around on the ground on that team, too, as I recall.
What do they think it is? Soccer?
Yep.
It was learned this week that the Sacramento Kings fired assistant director of scouting Jack Mai in January because he had been betting on games while he was with the team. I bet the NBA hopes the illegal betting ends there, but do you think it will?
I think that you're going to see a real steady stream of these now. I think any person with any the under-assistant West Coast promo man of the Celtics who went to a casino when he was in college is probably going to wind up getting fired. The NBA is very, very touchy on this stuff right now.
The longest tenured owner in the NBA died this week. Abe Pollin, who purchased the Baltimore Bullets in 1964, was 85 years old when he passed away. This was a man who presided over some enormous changes in a basketball franchise.
He did. The most conspicuous one, of course, was changing the name from the Washington Bullets to the Washington Wizards in response to some violence in the community in Washington, D.C. He never wavered. He stayed firm, and now the Washington Wizards are a staple NBA brand.
Allen Iverson retired this week, unless he didn't. Which NBA teams would be wise to consider adding him in his mid-30s to their roster?
None. He's demonstrated that he is not capable of accepting a reduced role, and a reduced role is all really his body will allow him to do now. I was hoping the original retirement report was correct.
By beating Andy Murray at the O2 Arena in London on Tuesday night, Roger Federer secured his spot as the number one ranked player in the tennis firmament at season's end. He has occupied that spot 5 times now. Do you suppose Pete Sampras, who finished on top a record 6 times, will be wishing Mr. Federer well when the next season begins?
I don't know, but I think you're going to see a lot of split-screen shots of those two as the majors go through the next season. The question, of course, is Rafael Nadal's health going to be better next year, because he seems to be the only one capable of assuming that spot outside of Federer.
For the 4th year in a row, Lorena Ochoa has been named LPGA Player of the Year. She also won her 4th straight Vare Trophy for having the lowest scoring average on the tour. But this time, the Player of the Year race went right down to the wire.
It did. It went down to the second last shot on the very last hole, the very last tournament of the year, when Jiayi Shin was unable to chip in for a birdie from the front of the green on the 18th hole, and that gave Ochoa the trophy. Anna Nordqvist won the tournament. And so it's one of those NASCAR things where it doesn't matter who wins the last
Precisely.
Event.
Precisely.
But this is an interesting little duel that shaped up.
And finally, Charlie, on Sunday in Premiership action, Tottenham Hotspur slipped by Wigan 9-1. This was a soccer game, so 9-1 is about like 63-7 in football, I guess. Are you surprised by the way Wigan's players responded?
Bill, I think I've probably seen maybe 150 soccer games in my life, including the ones my kids used to play when they were kids. I don't think I've seen 9 goals. And this happened in one game. Wigan, nobody goes to their games. They average 17,000 fans a game for their home games. They went 350 miles to watch this disaster. And not only that, but their goal is marred because it looked like it was a little Thierry Henry zut alors moment with the handball. But they are offering to refund the cost of the game tickets to their fans. I think it should all come out of the players' salaries myself.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time. And if he's not wise and funny some week, you can have back every penny you paid to listen to the program. So thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Among the listeners emailing us this week was Lawrence Scarron, who hears Only a Game on WXXI AM in Rochester, New York. He enjoyed Doug Trabue's story about the introduction of the goalie's mask to the sport of hockey and pointed out that the last shot Montreal goalkeeper Jacques Plante took to his unmasked face came courtesy of an Andy Bathgate wrist shot. Mr. Scarron reviewed film from November 1, 1959 to ascertain that detail, which is kind of neat. Meindert Papenhuyzen, who hears the program on WEPR in Greenville, South Carolina, and Charles Wood, who listens on WHQR in neighboring North Carolina, both emailed with a correction. Last week in my conversation with Charlie Pierce, I mentioned what was apparently an especially unfortunate pre-rugby match rendition of the South African national anthem. The match and the rendition occurred not in South Africa, as I had said, but in Toulouse, France. Charlie and I also discussed the objections some residents of Jupiter Island have had to the house Tiger Woods is building there. Our conversation provoked an email from Joe Biernat, who listens to Only a Game on his iPhone. "I was riding up Jupiter Island today," he wrote, "and just as I passed Tiger Woods' house/compound, I heard the comment about the neighbors not liking the style of his new home. First of all, they should talk. Is neo-Gothic faux European more attractive? But more to the point, the plantings around the property are so thick you cannot see Mr. Woods's home unless you are a peeping Tom. After having every muscle twitch under observation all day, he deserves some privacy." And finally, Jim Munn, the boys' track and field coach at Gloucester High School in Massachusetts, emailed to opine that we have shortchanged his sport. Referring to some of the stories in last week's program, Mr. Munn wrote, "While it's nice to hear about soccer during the Stalin regime and how the women's basketball program at Stanford is gearing up for a great season, why never any mention of high school and collegiate cross country? Could it be that these sports are the current popular sporting culture's equivalent of baseball's pre-World War II Negro leagues? Gee, we hope not, Coach. Those were some seriously long and uncomfortable bus rides. But we appreciate the tip, and we'll put that story on the list with any other story ideas you might send us via the website, onlyagame.org. You can also reach us by writing Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Five years ago, a football game of sorts featuring lingerie-clad women tempted some Super Bowl viewers to change channels during halftime. That brief television fling with females clad only in unmentionable somehow spawned the Lingerie Football League, which began its first season in September. We sent Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder, kicking and screaming, to San Diego to get to the bottom of the story, to witness the sheer madness, and to see whether the LFL is just one big bust in the making.
Erin Marie Garrett is a quadruple threat. She sings, acts, models, and on Friday nights likes to pummel other women.
You know, you kind of got your battle wounds as a trophy, so it's kind of cool to go home and be like, yeah, I got this playing football.
Garrett, or Crash as she's known, is also very attractive. Think Cameron Diaz meets Britney Spears. And it's that combination of killer instinct and killer looks that landed her on the defensive line of the Dallas Desire, one of 10 teams in the Lingerie Football League. That's right. Lingerie football.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this sports night as the new era of pro football kicks off in San Diego.
Tonight, the Desire are in San Diego to play the Seduction at the San Diego Sports Arena. I arrive early, along with 2,000 or so mostly male spectators, each of whom is glued to the pregame warm-up. Well-proportioned women wearing do-rags and tank tops run patterns across the AstroTurf. To my surprise, one man I talked to, Shadow Jenkins, is actually focusing on the football, and he likes what he sees in Dallas quarterback Linda Brenner.
She has actually proper mechanics. The other one, not so much.
Just before kickoff, the arena goes dark, Smoke pours out of a tunnel, and strobe lights flash. It feels more like a nightclub than a football game, which, according to league president Mitch Mortaza, is precisely the point.
It's about the Friday night experience. You grab your friends, you cop a couple beers, and you come out and you have a heck of a time, whether your team wins or loses.
Tonight is San Diego's first game, and it gets off to a rough start. The chains aren't in place, nobody knows who to give the ball to, and during the Seduction's first play from scrimmage, the play clock expires. Lingerie football debuted in 2004 as a pay-per-view Super Bowl halftime special. This year, it's expanding to a regular season. 10 teams from Miami to Seattle each play a four-game schedule. The conference winners will square off in Lingerie Bowl 7 during halftime of this year's Super Bowl. Unlike the NFL, however, the LFL doesn't have big marketing dollars. So Mortaza hopes to attract fans with a more viral approach.
If you go online tonight after this game and you watch the Twitter boards, the Facebook boards, fans go crazy. They say, I cannot believe what I saw.
Many fans I run into near the concession stand during halftime don't wait until they're home to express their disbelief. One, Dan Steelwell, a wide-eyed Navy cryptologic technician, has painted his face blue with the number 17 written in white over both cheeks.
Well, you know, number 17, that's my Hooters waitress, Kendra Myers. She's starting linebacker and tight end for San Diego Seduction.
Steelwell and his friend Mongo frequent a local Hooters every Monday night where Myers waits on them.
And she happened to talk to us and ask us if we would like to see women playing in bras and boy shorts.
And you said no. I've got something else to do.
And I said, yes, where is it at?
What does Mongo think of Myers' play tonight?
Amazing. Identical on the field as she is in Hooters.
Mongo's in the Navy too, but he's not a cryptologic technician.
I blow stuff up for a living.
He's watched highlights online in anticipation of tonight's game, but he says nothing compares to the live experience of watching beautiful women battling on the gridiron.
It is amazing. Absolutely amazing, because you know what? It shows that they're actually physically athletes. It's not just about being women and scantily wearing outfits. It's about football, and everybody loves football.
Like Lauren Perlman, another fan. Just don't tell him what he's watching is real football.
I expected scantily clad women to be playing a game that somewhat touched upon football, and in fact it has, in every way.
This is, after all, a new league and a sport very few women play. On top of that, the rules are different. It looks more like arena football than typical Sunday afternoon fare. The games take place indoors on a 50-yard field. There's padding along the sidelines. There's seven players per side, no field goals, and teams have to go for it on fourth down. Then there are the uniforms. Modeling agent Lacey Chavez-Smith used to rep some of the players. What's her favorite part of the uniform?
The bows.
Four bows in all that hang off the player's shorts. Each woman also wears a garter. Want to know their number? It's located on the right buttocks of their shorts. The bras are so small, the women make sure there hasn't been a wardrobe malfunction after each play. Suffice to say, there are no Wilhelmina the Refrigerator Perrys on the field. Again, Lauren Perlman.
I think the type of women that would actually be able to play football at a reasonable level that men would be interested in are not the type we'd want to see in bikinis.
But, Chavez-Smith tells me, the girls don't mind the lack of clothing.
They have great physiques, they take care of themselves, and they're proud.
And, says Mitch Mortaza, they're not all models.
We have lawyers, we have doctors, we have cocktail waitresses, we have mothers. I think we have one grandmother in this league, believe it or not. So it's all walks of life.
As easy as it may be to write off lingerie football as powder puff, it's not. Most LFL players participated in a college sport, and they hit each other hard. Again, Erin Marie Garrett.
We've got to come in here, we've got to prove that we are actual athletes. And in order to do that, we've just got to get out there. People are seeing it happen.
Thanks for coming. Please drive safely and hope to see you at our next game in January. Good night.
Even though Dallas dominates San Diego tonight 40-6, the hometown fans don't seem to mind. They've remained in the arena and on their feet till the final whistle. Mongo tells me that's because the lingerie players aren't afraid to tackle and hit. You know, like those wimpy NFL players.
Man, that's not what this football's about. Football's about crushing people. Football's about putting your heart on the line. These girls do it for the fans. They don't do it for oh, I'm getting paid, I'm getting $1 million per anything. They go out here to crush people so that people out here can see what's going on.
And for these fans, that's helped to make it the ultimate fantasy football experience. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder.
I plan on not having a voice for the next, 3 days. No voice for 3 days.
East is east and west is west, and the wrong one I have chose. Let's go where I'll keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help this week from Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Charlie Schroeder's Lingerie Football League photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Northeastern University Athletic Director Peter Roby, who planned to attend a Huskies Terriers men's basketball game right across the street from the Only a Game offices.
You may see my figure across the plain of BU, and hopefully it's still standing when you see it.
All was well at that epic midweek tilt, unless that was Mr. Roby sleeping in the nosebleed section. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Where gals keep using those silks and satins and linen that shows, and I'm all yours in buttons and bows.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.